Raises another question, I guess, and that is, trying to think how to phrase it. You working in the lab yourself, did you ever reach a point where you no longer, you know, where I've talked to a number of people where there's a, sometimes very early in their career, it's a point where they no longer are working in the lab. I had the feeling Harlan Wood, even the day I was there, he was out in the lab with his students doing something. So I wonder what your situation was.
My situation was that up until the time of the second edition of the Principles of Biochemistry, I worked in the lab. When I first came to Utah, I started out with one technician, and I had one or two postdoctoral fellows and a student or two. As long as the number of people that I was responsible for was about five or six, and I had no real administrative responsibilities other than running my own lab, I put in a fair amount of time in the lab myself. Beginning in the 1949 or 50, I was asked to serve on an NIH study section, which meant three meetings a year and a lot of applications to read, travel to Washington three times a year. Then in 1950-51, we started work on the Principles of Biochemistry. And I was still able to get into the lab fair amount. But I no longer could carry a problem that required me to be there every day. So frequently, I was the one who did the synthetic work on peptides. You could do a couple of reactions, and you could let the stuff crystallize in the refrigerator for a couple of days. In fact, sometimes you're better off just leaving it there for a few days than trying to work it up right away. And if you didn't get there for a week or two, it still didn't make any difference. It was sitting under an organic solvent, well stoppered, and let the stuff crystallize. Then when you got time, you came in and filtered it off, recrystallized it if need be, had it analyzed or did what you have to do, and then went on to the next step. Carrying on enzyme purifications with my own hands became impossible from the early 50s on. But doing organic work or doing analytical work of some kinds was still feasible. Doing enzyme assays was still feasible because you could let things accumulate. By the time we got into the second edition of the Principles of Biochemistry, which I guess was in the mid-50s, where I was working every night and every weekend on the book, and the literature was literally exploding at that time. Golden age of intermediary metabolism. Then came the point also at which the lab was expanding because, in a certain sense, because of our successes. The more you publish, the more people want to come. And it got to the point around 1954-55 where I had about a dozen people. And at that point, I said, enough is enough. From that point on, I never had more than 10 people in the lab, including postdocs, students, technicians. Now, I always had two technicians, Doug Brown, who worked for the whole laboratory, and after we came here, for the whole department. He did all the ultracentrifuge work and all the electrophoresis for everybody. And I always had one full-time person running the amino acid analysis. I required all the postdocs and graduate students to do it at least once or twice themselves so they knew what it was about. But I regarded it as silly for a talented postdoctoral fellow to spend time doing routine analysis for several hours every day, which was ridiculous. they ought to be spending their time doing more creative work than doing routine analyses or routine running of an ultracentrifuge or routine running of electrophoresis. So we always had at least two technicians in the lab, and the rest were students and postdocs. 10 became my upper limit so that I could see what was going on every day that I was around. And whenever I was in town, I certainly made the rounds every single day and talked to everybody in the lab, find out what was going on. If it gets above a certain limit, you lose touch. And it's no longer fun as far as I'm concerned. And that's what happened. So the cutoff point was sometime in the mid-50s.
How did you feel about that, about making that transition for more?
Well, it was gradual. It was gradual, and there was no real way to avoid it if I were going to continue with the obligation. And part of the obligation, in a certain sense, with a book, if you do it once and it's a failure, you say, okay, you wash your hands in the hell with it, forget about it, and never do it again. But what do you do if it's a success? The publisher is after you, for one thing, and you have an obligation to your co-authors, for the other, and financially it was useful. It was fruitful. It helped to pay for some college education, it helped to put away some money for the future, because certainly at that time, in Utah particularly, the salaries were not all that generous, and the retirement possibilities were pretty poor. Things have improved since. So that we had a success on our hands. And from that point on, we had to do a new edition every 5 years, basically.
Just as an aside, I discovered that in our collection of the principles, we have one edition, I'm not sure which one it is, which all of you have signed. And I think it came from the publisher. I don't think it...
Very likely.
But
we signed slips and they pasted them in.
But I was struck in looking at them when I was reviewing the first transcript that we had one in which all of you had actually signed the copy. That we
so that may have been, I don't know which one.
It seems to me it's the second one. I think that's the one. But
the red label and the...
Right, the gray. The
yeah. That's probably the second one. I think, in retrospect, the most revolutionary and the most important editions were the third and the fourth. By then, we had been so successful and had done such a good job that everybody was copying and were imitators all over the place. That's what happened. The field exploded. And there were a lot more students, there were a lot more places, and biochemistry departments expanded enormously. And
I've forgotten when Leninger came out with his first edition. Was that in the 50s sometime, or was it later?
It was certainly after our second edition, maybe after our third. And Leninger did a good job. He also used our edition very heavily in writing his. He wrote very well. And it reflects, his general reflected his interests. Ours was a more diverse kind of interest because we had different people with different interests that emphasized. He gave us plenty of competition. But on the other hand, our sales didn't suffer all that much. The field expanded, basically,
right,
what it amounted to. What surprises me is that even our seventh edition, which isn't there, that's at my desk, we're still selling a few copies, mostly abroad. Still going on. Even though it's 10 years out now.
That long ago already, since
83.
Yes.
Came out in January 83. 11 years.
It's probably, and I think we discussed this the last time, but it is probably somewhat of a record for longevity of a book of this nature, of a textbook of this nature, for that 30 years or so, that many editions.
Yes.
I would think it's going to be hard to keep the interest going. We talked about that. For that length of time, the level of interest to keep up with the changes.
Well, we're finished with it, obviously. And partly, of the original co-authors, they're all gone. And the younger people that we brought in, particularly for this last edition, they decided it isn't worth the time. Partly, I suppose, it's too difficult now. Every field is exploding so much. And I don't think there's any book that is going to satisfy any market anymore. My colleagues downstairs don't use a book. They use their own mimeographed outlines, and the way they teach is quite different. Quite different.
So you think there might be a book on proteins, a book on nucleic acids?
Part of what used to be called biochemistry is now taught in the clinic. A large part of physiology is now taught in the clinic. Teaching of medical students, we're talking about. Graduate student teaching is entirely different. There is no satisfactory book for teaching undergraduate biochemistry. My oldest son teaches undergraduate biochemistry. He says, every book is terrible. We do what we can. And students want a book, but you have to pick and choose, and then you spend a fair amount of time correcting mistakes. Nobody wants to do it. In a way, this is a measure of our success academically, in that salaries have become fairly adequate. Nobody wants to bother writing a book. And books are expensive now. So I don't know what the situation is going to be in fields like this. I don't know what the situation is. Probably for general chemistry it's easier because you've got tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people take general chemistry every year. There can be a few books that are successful, and they don't have to be revised that often because general elementary chemistry doesn't change that much.
My experience has been that they are revised often because the publisher wants to be able to sell new copies.
And doesn't want the second-hand ones around. They all want, we used to kid the publisher, they all want a self-destructive edition.
Yes.
That'll explode spontaneously or become unreadable after X years.
That's a good way of putting it. Cytochromes. How'd your work start on cytochromes?
Well, I had been known about cytochromes ever since I was in Kalin's lab. After all, he had discovered cytochromes. Cytochrome C had become available in pure form before any of the other cytochromes. It was a very small protein. And Emmanuel Margoliash was one of the first people to apply modern chromatographic methods for the purification of cytochrome in Kalin's lab, where he was a postdoc from Israel, which meant that you could make pure cytochrome C very easily. I first met him at that time in 1955. He went back to Israel, and he was very unhappy because he had a job in cancer research, which was getting nowhere at the time, as cancer research wasn't anywhere at that time, and wanted to get into modern biochemistry. He was in Israel only by a curious set of circumstances. His parents had lived in the United States, and his two older brothers were born here. But his father was in the importing business and then decided to move to Cairo to import, to sell rugs for export from Cairo, buying rugs all over the Middle East. That was his family business. So Emmanuel Margoliash was born in Cairo, of all things, even though his parents were American citizens, actually, originally. And when he was educated partly in Cairo and then at the American University in Beirut, where he obtained his master's degree in chemistry and his medical degree, And then when things were happening in that part of the Middle East, he migrated to Israel. He was completely trilingual. The schools that he attended in Cairo were French. That was the tradition. The American university schooling was English. The English was flawless. He also knew some Arabic. So he talked to me about coming here. And we arranged a postdoctoral fellowship for him to come work in our lab for 2 years. He wanted to learn modern protein chemistry, in effect. So he came with the notion that there was an inhibitor that had been people discovered in agriculture, I've even forgotten the name of it now, which strongly binds to catalase. And because it strongly binds to catalase, it's very effective as a herbicide against certain plants, certain weed plants. So he thought of using this herbicide as a way of binding, making it C14 and binding it to the active site of catalase and then seeing where the heme group was attached in catalase. It's all interesting history as to how things happen. So he came to the lab. I said, you know, this is silly. For two reasons. Why tackle a protein of a couple of 100,000 molecular weight when all you're going to get is a little piece, and what are you going to know after you find out how it's attached? Second of all, my friend Walter Schroeder at Caltech has already started work on the complete sequence of catalase, which of course he wouldn't know. But the word was around that everybody knew what everybody else was working on, and if possible you avoided what anybody else was working on, let them have a free hand. So I said, look, you're the one who isolated pure cytochrome C. How about working on the sequence of cytochrome C? It's nice and small. Oh, why don't we work first on the heme attachment site? I said, that's silly. Why don't we do the whole thing? We know how to separate the peptides. You do a chymotryptic digestion. Don't do a tryptic digestion. There are too many lysines in there. You'll get tiny little peptides. You want bigger peptides. He said, okay. So we started out that way. After all, we had all the enzymes. We had all the amino acid analysis. We had all the techniques. So he could just go ahead and use them. So we started out doing horse heart cytochrome C, which was basically done in about a year. Year and a half, something like that. We were just about finished with the chymotryptic peptides and were ready to start the tryptic peptides when we had a visit from Hans Tuppy from Vienna, who had been Fred Sanger's first graduate student. And I had met him. He came in, we started to talk. It turned out that Hans Tuppy had a graduate student named Gunther Kreil who was working on the tryptic peptides from cytochrome C. And with what he already knew and what we knew, we could put together most of the complete sequence. So we agreed, let Gunther Kreil get his PhD and finish up the tryptic peptides and see where we are. And we'd withhold publication until he caught up with us. This was in the winter of, or early spring of 60-61. In 61, I was going to the International Congress of Biochemistry in Moscow, and we sent off an abstract, slightly weasel-worded, but indicating that we would present the complete amino acid sequence of cytochrome C. On the way there, my wife and I stopped in Vienna to spend a few days with Hans Tuppy and got the rest of the sequence and put it all together, and we presented it. We had gotten corresponded by mail, actually, and had it all set out. We presented in 61, and then we published three simultaneous papers in Nature. Our first paper was the amino acid composition and the chymotryptic peptides from our laboratory, Margoliesh and I. The second paper was Kreil and Tuppy on the tryptic peptides, and the third paper combining the two for the complete sequence as a joint effort. And then, of course, the complete versions we published separately. So that's how it got started. And then, of course, once you do, Margolyash decided not to go back to Israel. He wanted a career over here. So we arranged that he would go to Montreal to work at McGill University for 2 years, so that he could fulfill the legal requirements of having been a scholar here, to go out of the country for 2 years and then reapply. And then he came back to the United States, where he worked at Abbott Laboratories for a number of years. So that's the history. We then went on, of course, to study other cytochromes because of my early interest in the evolution of proteins. Back in Connecticut in 1939, I had isolated a whole family of seed globulins from the cucurbitaceae, these oil seed proteins from pumpkin, squash, cantaloupe, honeydew melon, all related in the same species. They all stored amino acids in the form of storage proteins. And I isolated all of them and determined the composition in terms of arginine, sulfur, cysteine, tyrosine, and tryptophan. Showed that they were all homologous. Sequences unknown, of course, at that time. So here was a family of proteins that obviously had derived from a common ancestor. So that was my first foray into the evolution of proteins. The cytochrome was quite obvious. We did human cytochrome, we did dog, we did a number of other species, and after doing a few mammalian species, we branched out. And it's quite clear that cytochrome C originated very early in aerobic life, because it is homologous whether you look at it from higher plants or from higher animals, and tracing it all the way back. So that here is a protein that is at least as old as the ancestral species before the divergence of animal and plant life, which means it is as old as mitochondria. About 1.5 billion years.
Well, that evolutionary interest stayed with you all the time.
Oh, yes. But later I dropped it all for this simple sense that after a while it begins to become taxonomy and is no longer of interest as protein chemistry.
Where was your support coming from at this point? Still from NIH?
NIH, Rockefeller, and I had some support from the American Cancer Society.
This was still a time when support was still pretty easy to come by.
Very easy to come by. Let's take a break. I'm going to get a drink. Okay.
Turned on.
Well, this is an anecdote that has to do with the library. It has nothing to do with science.
Sure.
I was talking to the librarian, former librarian, Whit Bell, who's now writing biographical history of all the early members of the Philosophical Society. Well, it turned out some years ago, I was asked by the people here to give a short talk about the history of the Philosophical Society and the American Academy when new members were being honored at some kind of a reception. And since I was at that time, the only member of both who happened to be available, I was asked to give a little bit of the early history. So I read some of it and discovered that the first woman who had been elected to the Philosophical Society was a Russian named Yekaterina Dashkova, as a foreign member. And I asked Whit Bell whether he knew anything about her, and he says, I can't find out a damn thing about it. I said, would you like to, do you have a copy of Alexander Herzen's memoirs, who was a great Russian patriot, author, whatnot, back in the middle of the 19th century. He said, no. Well, we looked in the library, there was no mention of anything. I said, you know, he wrote a long essay about Dashkova, which I read, and I happened to have the 4-volume translation of Herzen's memoirs, including all his occasional papers translated into English. He said, fascinating, we'd love to have it. I said, okay, when I get home, I'll send it to you. So I sent it to him. He wrote back all excited. He said, as soon as it arrived, he sat down and read the whole thing. So then I wrote back and said, look, I have a number of other things in the history of science and biochemistry and whatnot. Why don't I send you lists and you pick out what you want? I'll send them. So I've been doing this now for a couple of years, sending stuff, sending them lists, and they check off what they don't have. And in a couple of cases, I've been able to give them first editions when they had seconds.
Wow. That's wonderful. Well, that's how many collections are built when you have that. You just can't go out and buy things.
Well, I happen to have, for example, half a dozen books in English on the early history of alchemy. It was interesting to me. I don't read Arabic, but there were a lot of English scholars, particularly in Britain, who wrote about alchemy because they read Arabic, which I did. Well, I'm not going to read these again. I satisfied my interest in them. It turned out that four of these they didn't have.
That's amazing. We had one donation, again, just as a slight aside. One of our board members came down from New York to one of our meetings, and I saw him come in the back door, and he had his New York Times, and he had a picture frame stuck inside the New York Times under his arm. After the meeting, he said to Dr. Thackeray, this is something that's been in our attic. I think you should probably have it. My father bought it at an auction in the 1930s. And it turned out to be Isaac Newton's family tree written in his hand. It's been appraised at, I don't know, $5,000-$10,000.
I should hope so.
And it was just stuck in a newspaper, not even wrapped or anything, under his arm on the train from New York.
Well, that's the best way to carry it. Nobody would bother with it. Safest way.
Well, why don't we continue on with the next area, I may not pronounce it right, but in 62 we started on the subtilisons.
Subtilisons.
Subtilisons, okay, B side. Okay. You had a Japanese come to your lab. How did all that, he actually suggested it, didn't he? Is that how that got started?
Yeah. He came over to learn our methods. By the way, Hiroshi Matsubara has just retired as professor of biochemistry and dean of science at Osaka University in Japan. That's what happens. He'd come to learn our methods, so I put him to work on human cytochrome C. And in very short order, he had completed the work on human cytochrome C. And he suggested a proteolytic enzyme on which he had done some work in Japan. We might have a look at it from a physical viewpoint, chemical viewpoint. This was subtilisons. Now, the subtilisons were originally discovered in Copenhagen, Denmark. And I knew the whole story, because these people were all friends of mine. Lindstrom Lang, who had been the director of the Carlsberg Laboratory, had discovered, because he'd been working on ovalbumin, the protein from hen's egg, and ovalbumin makes nice needles as crystals, but there'd been a batch of ovalbumin sitting in the refrigerator that obviously become contaminated by bacteria, and there were no longer any crystals there. Instead, there were plates, and Lindstrom Lang proceeded to call that plaque albumin instead of ovalbumin, and it was worked out that the proteolytic enzyme from these bacteria that had contaminated this thing had cut off a piece of ovalbumin, and the ovalbumin had gone into a new crystal form. So they proceeded to isolate the enzyme from what was Bacillus subtilis and gave it the name subtilisin. It comes from Bacillus subtilis.